is this?
This is tape number two, side number one of our interview with Don Smale. It was part of the oral history project on the everyday lives of the last generation of underground miners. This is a continuation of our interview on April 14th, 1994 at her home. While I was switching tapes, she mentioned that she would like to talk a little bit more about food and stretching the available grocery budget.
When we were involved in one of the mine layoffs, maybe it was during Honeydew Week, I'm not quite sure, but surplus foods were available, government surplus foods, and we were never on welfare. We never saved money at that time in savings, but we didn't go in debt either. We managed to squeak by and pay our bills. But we would have surplus foods, and they were good. There was cornmeal, there was powdered milk, and butter. And we felt fortunate that we had these to supplement what we could buy and what we could grow in the garden. And it kept us afloat.
Let's talk a little bit more about layoffs. Do you recall how many times Lowell would have been laid off and for how long?
I remember when there was a layoff. Ooh, I can't tell you. In the 50s. And it was not long after we had adopted Michael. And in church we met a family who were living in a motel and needed to find a place to rent for the summer. They wanted to get out of the cramped motel. They had three kids. And so we came home, we talked about it, and Lowell said, "Don, why don't we rent the house?" So we rented our house furnished, and we moved out to camp. It was unfinished, just some flooring and no insulation in the walls or anything, but there was four walls and a roof and a floor and an outhouse. So we moved out there, and the deal was then he would give Lowell a job. And he said, "What do you do?" Lowell said, "I'll do common labor." And we did. We rented that summer. And by fall, they had found a house, which happened to be the home of a cousin of ours who wanted to rent. So they were satisfied, and we were satisfied. And that was when Lowell worked as a common laborer up at the Republic Mine Project as they were building. And the following summer, Lowell still was not back at the mines and doing whatever he could in construction or whatever. And we rented our home a second time to family and survived again that year, which meant we had money then to make house payments. And they were some of the nicest summers. Those two summers were the most wonderful summers we had at camp. The kids were young enough to be in the water like seals all day long. And the typical kids would be at their camp, so we'd come back and forth and play, and it worked both ways. It was the Republic Mine was close to where Lowell to us, I think 12 miles by dirt road, and so he could ride back and forth and come home, and he'd work on the camp. And again, you know, he had to do all the work. He'd work his 8 hours, come home, do either work on the house to finish the house or work on the camp to finish the camp, wherever we happened to be. But that's how we got by during those layoffs.
If it had not been for renting the house, what would you have done?
I don't know. There again, I think it was divine providence. That's why we believe so firmly that the Lord is with us, because whenever we were in a tight spot, somehow we came through. We believe in prayer.
I'd like to talk about camp a little bit. For those people who grew up in the UP, camp is a very familiar term, but for those who have not grown up here, there's one perception of camp that might be a little different than what the UP definition of camp is. I'd like you to define it for me if you can, and then describe for me the circumstances in which you acquired property, and was there already a structure on it, or how that all progressed.
When the men came home from service, property was opened up on Casey Lake, And initially, it could have been purchased for maybe $4,000 or $5,000, all the properties around the lake. But who had $5,000? We didn't.
That's the whole lake for
$5,000. The whole lake, as I understand it. My father said that the jobber that was his chum and who gave Lowell work when Lowell first came home from service was offered it, but he thought it was so far out and so godforsaken, who would want to be there? Then the property opened up and it was sold for $150 for a 100-foot lot of lake frontage. Well, Grabber Hill offered us the money, but we thought, how are we ever going to pay back $150?
Grandpa Hill is?
My father, the children's grandpa, Russell Hill. And so we turned him down, and he said, well, I've got it, but we didn't. And about a year after we adopted Michael in 1957, we built a camp because one of the men who had bought one of the original lots on the lake decided she wanted to live at a lake that was much closer off a paved highway at Little Perch. And when my brother Dewey heard about it, and he said, if you want to get some property, here's a lot for sale, we immediately called this man, and he wanted $500. He made $350 profit, which my husband thought was astronomical. But we bought the property for $500, and today the property is worth upwards of $35,000 to $5,000. You know, lake frontage is premium. Then we hired, and my uncle said to us, if you're going to build while the kids are little so that they can enjoy it, because once they're gone or get jobs in the summer when they're teenagers, you'll never get out there. So that's what we did, and we did the same thing there as we did with the house. We built and paid for what we could and waited until we had enough money to add on. And the camp still isn't finished, but today it's not a camp. It's a retirement home, really. It's carpeted and electricity. We had a pump to pump water, a hand pump, and we had kerosene lamps. And later on, when the electricity was finally put out there, our girl said, you can't do that. We like the kerosene lamps. And I said, I like the conveniences and flipping a switch. But when you're out there, you can light the lamps if you wish. But we call them camps in the UP. Other people call them cottages. And I suppose it's just a matter of semantics. For us, it's a retreat. And now that Lowell and I are retired, we plan on spending a whole lot more, but here we are, both of us, just 70 years old, and this is the first time that we feel free enough to of other obligations to be able to go out and just stay, because we have Dixie Lee Smale living with us for the past 14 years. She's a niece. Her mother was my twin. Her daddy was Hugh Smale, Lowell's brother, and when her mom and dad were dead, why, she lived with Granny, and then when Granny Hill died, Dixie's lived with us for 14 years. But now she's retired from the Sheltered Workshop and Special Olympics and all the practices and involvements that I had involvement in. Now we're free to go to camp and stay there. And Dixie is now in the mid-stage Alzheimer's. And so we're going to go out there and enjoy the fruits of our labor.
Okay, you mentioned honeydew.
Honeydew.
What is honeydew?
Honeydew was a time when the man worked 3 weeks and had 1 week off. And by that time, we had a list of things that the men could do. And because so many of our husbands were do-it-yourselfers, that's how we stretched our pay is our own labor. Then they would do all the odd jobs that we wanted done, and we called it honeydew week. It was a kind of an affectionate term.
As in honeydew this and honeydew that?
As in honeydew this and honeydew that.
You mentioned gardening. Did most of your family and acquaintances have gardens, I presume vegetable gardens? If so, approximately how big and approximately what kinds of things would you grow, and would you can or freeze or eat the produce in the summertime only? How did that go?
When I was growing up, we had our own chickens, geese, turkeys, cows, pigs, sheep for wool, and a big garden space. In fact, we're built right on smack dab in my grandfather's big potato garden. Dewey's house is up in the what used to be the sheep pen. Dixie's house on the corner was another garden, because they would alternate, you know, to get their crops. Well, when we were married and built here, then our lot being 100 by 70, we didn't have that much space, and so we didn't raise a whole lot. Dewey's the one with the beautiful garden. You'll have to talk to him about that. But we did some freezing of foods when the time came that we had a freezer. Prior to that, no, I didn't do as much canning. My mother did a lot of canning and preparation of foods, and I got so sick of it then that I didn't want to do any when I was married.
I want to follow up on something now. You've just outlined that on the same block were your mother, your sister, who was married to your husband's brother, and your brother. There's a whole block. Is there any, are there any other family members living on this block? And is it very typical in your experience that there were many families who would spread out and then occupy the same part of a neighborhood?
There were some. My grandfather owned most of one block, a good two-thirds, I would think. And so my uncle built his home on one side of Granddad, and we built on the lower corner of Marble and what's now North Lake Road. They changed the name so many times. And then Dixie and Hugh built their house on Copper and North Lake Road at 105 Copper. Dewey, Irene had a lot that was between Hugh and Dewey, and subsequently she sold it to Dewey. But we built on these pieces of property because it was Granddad wouldn't sell to anyone except family. And he said to my mother, if you want to give them to your children, okay. And then across the road from my brother was another 40 acres that Granddad leased from the CCI. But when he died, it was a 99-year lease, but when he died, it was no longer valid. It didn't carry on to the rest of us. We felt badly about that because that was our cow pasture and sheep pasture, and we used to love to roam through the woods and play in there. But there were other families out here whose children bought lots next to them, but not as many. We were kind of a real cluster here.
So your situation was quite unique then. Wasn't
typical. We were unique, right. We were unique.
Let's talk about extended families for a little bit. Obviously, there were some real close ties with your extended family. Was it typical for there to be large extended families in the same community, that being like in Ishpeming or Negaunee or the combination of the two? And if there were extended families in pretty close proximity, are you aware that people would spend a lot of time with their extended families, or would they spend more of their social time with friends instead, or was it a combination?
We spent a lot more time with extended family and friends. Playing cards at night, once a week, my sister Irene and Bernard and the Bengries, and we would have times when we'd all get together and visit, especially the birthday parties of the children. We always were at each other's homes to celebrate the birthdays. We still do. We all get together for a birthday coffee. That's one thing that we've never given up on. At one time when the children were little, we always exchanged gifts, and we handmade gifts to be able to do it. But when we began building homes, it got to be a little more than we could handle, and so we decided that we would cut out giving each other's children gifts because they were well provided for anyway. Amongst friends, in the communities, yeah, we didn't have TV early on, and so it was a lot more social. And some of the social organizations we were involved in were Job's Daughters and Eastern Star, and Lowell for a while belonged to the Lions Club. But later on, we got too busy as the kids got bigger, and they had involvements. Then we kind of let ours go by the board, and we didn't belong. But now that there's TV, I live next door to my brother and to my uncle, and except for birthdays and stepping outside in the backyard and talking over the back fence or the gardens, checking on each other's gardens, we don't seem to have the time anymore to just go and visit the way we did 40 years ago.
Birthdays was something I wanted to ask about. You mentioned birthday coffee. Is birthday coffee a common term? Is that something that's done in the community, or is that a family thing?
I guess it might be just family, but well, mankind has always enjoyed sitting over food and sharing. If you have someone and they come to your home to visit, you offer them something to eat. It used to be that we would have a birthday coffee, and there was cake and ice cream, and sometimes we'd make pizzas, and sometimes we would provide a whole variety of foods. But as we're all in our 70s and early 80s and cholesterol conscious, our menus have really changed, and we don't really mind because we still like getting together, and we all realize that we're the top generation now because our parents are gone. Excuse me. We're the old generation, and we appreciate the times that we get together when we're just happy, not gathering because somebody died or there's been a dreadful illness or some other kind of not too happy time.
Let's talk a little bit also about birthday parties when the kids were smaller. What was a typical birthday party like?
It meant that, for us, it meant that the Linda boys, two little boys, came, that the Tippett girls came down from next door, and Roxy and Melody, and then depending on their school friends, when they got older and were going to the lower grades, they would come over, and it was cake and ice cream and pop and balloons and paper hats.
Paper hats made out of what kind of paper?
Paper hats made out of crepe paper, and we made our own, and that was part of the preparation. We liked that. And, of course, you came dressed up. The little boys came in pants and shirts and little ties or some such, and the girls always wore their pretty dresses. Nowadays, people go everywhere in blue jeans, and if they have holes in the knees, that's even better, I guess. But birthdays were dress-up. That was a special time. And we had a special party one year where we had a circus party, and it was Roxy's party, and the snow was gone. No, it was Melody's party. It was in July. And so we had little cages, and we put cats and dogs, various pets were in cages, and they were the lions and the tigers. And we had rabbits, and we had a popcorn stand, and we had a Kool-Aid stand, and we had circus records and marches. And we played games outdoors in the backyard. It was one of the most fun parties that we had, that circus party. And it was great.
What would a typical birthday present be? as a gift from parents to kids or from kids to other kids. Do you remember? And also, were there typical birthday party games that were pretty much done at all the birthday parties?
Oh, yes. Always pin the tail on the donkey. And then some little inexpensive prizes, balloons, pencils, erasers, maybe tablets, maybe a coloring book. But, and then for the children, for our children, we usually gave them something that they wanted or needed. I remember one year when Melody wanted a table and chairs, and that's what she had for her birthday. Or it could be another dolly. For Roxy, it was a globe or another horse statue. For Michael, it was always another car. Things didn't always last too long. So it was or a new tricycle or a bicycle. According to what we could afford as well.
One of the things we didn't talk about is the availability of stores in which to purchase other things than groceries. Most people now in the 80s and 90s, especially if you live in an urban area, the mall is the place to shop. Where did you shop for other things than groceries during the time the kids were growing up, say in the 50s?
We never shopped for anything beyond Ishpeming because there were enough stores here. There was a JCPenney, a Sears.
Was the Sears a retail store or a catalog store?
It was retail and catalog. Montgomery Ward's was retail and catalog. There was a Qualls furniture store. There were hardware stores, Jackson's Hardware. There was another hardware. I can't think of his name. There was Kirk's Shoe Store. There was the Style Shop, which was more expensive ready-made clothing that I didn't shop in because I couldn't afford it unless it was a sale. About everything on sale. I still buy on sale because the markup is too much and I have too much Scotch background to allow myself to spend that much money on something I could get later on. There were hat shops. There were millinery shops I'm talking about. There was one, I think. And there was the Gossard factory, and I worked in that shop, and I worked in there while Lowell was in service off and on because I kept going to visit him while he was overseas, while he was in the States at various bases. But there was an F.W. Woolworth store, and then there was a J.J. Newberry store, which were five and dimes. So we didn't have to go out of Ishpeming. I could have bought anything I wanted right here in Ishpeming.
Now, your mention of the Woolworth store and the Newberry store, what kinds of things would you buy there? And specifically, were there household goods, like maybe dishes, that you would have purchased there? And was that, what kinds of dishes and cooking utensils and things like that would people use typically?
Well, they would have sold dishes. I don't remember where I bought my first set of dishes or dishes for. I think I bought dishes at from Ward's when Lowell came home from overseas, and utensils I bought in Jackson's Hardware. Not too many because we couldn't afford it. As long as we had a tea kettle, had to have a teapot because we are English and we always have tea. Did have a coffee pot, a mixer, and I think Lowell bought that at Ward's. Gave that to me for a Christmas gift one year. And J.J. Newberry carried yard goods, so you could go there and buy yard goods and thread. J.C. Penney carried yard goods, and I bought a lot of yard goods there. It was only after the era of malls, and when the malls came into Marquette, that the other stores gradually closed out and moved away until we have no stores with yard goods. And I don't know if there's anyone in Ishpeming that sells hats. The Style Shop is still here, but JCPenney is gone, Ward's is gone, Sears is gone, and the small local hardware stores are struggling to stay alive.
What about catalogs? Did you ever rely much on catalogs? I know there are a lot of specialty catalogs and things out, but where did catalogs fit into purchasing things when the kids were growing up?
Montgomery Ward's and Sears put out catalogs. We always got them. Christmas time, we might send for Christmas things. They always put out special Christmas catalogs. And we might buy things from them, but mainly we bought locally. Qualls always had a wonderful selection of toys. Their whole second floor would go into toys and Christmas games and things, and I would go there, and sometimes I bought for what the kids would enjoy, but sometimes I bought things that I knew I would enjoy. But we used catalogs, and ultimately, you know, they were relegated to the outhouses because the standing joke was you never used the shiny paper, and we didn't get too involved in that, except that, you know, we never had an outhouse except out at camp. And then we didn't really use the catalogs anymore either. But we didn't buy is anything from specialty catalogs. It was just Ward's and Sears. And most of that was if there was an appliance, then we would maybe go there and buy a large appliance, but they carry them in the retail, and if they didn't have it, then of course they would send for it, bring it in, and then we would get it.
And when you say send for, were you talking about placing an order by phone, or was it a pencil and paper
they
order
would,
blank that you mailed?
No, they would order it by phone. Most of the business on appliances that we would buy, the stores, the retail store would say, well, we don't have it, but we'll get it for you, and then they would.
And do you remember how long it would take if something more special ordered, like an appliance, how long it would take to get to the store and then to your home?
It usually was a week or 10 days, maybe 2 weeks.
This is the end of side one. This is tape number two, side number two of the interview with Don Smeal on April 14th, 1994. One of the things that we haven't really talked about that I really want to get into in a little bit of depth is the mining-related daily routine, the preparation of lunch boxes, what went in it, who did it, and also mine clothing and how it was laundered and how frequently.
Lowell described his lunchbox to you, and it held a thermos and a compartment for his sandwiches. He carried two sandwiches, peanut butter and jam. Didn't matter if it was strawberry or raspberry or whatever, but he loved peanut butter and jam and a banana and a Twinkie. And I would prepare his lunch in the morning while I was giving him his breakfast. And his breakfast was usually a cup of tea and either toast or oatmeal.
And he would get up at what time? You would get up at what time in the morning, and he would leave at what time about?
He would get up at 6 or quarter to 6. I would get up at quarter to 6. He would get up at 6, and he would leave the home at 6:30 and drive to work.
Let's talk about the mining laundry. He described having to change into his mining clothes once he got to work and then taking them home every week or two. What peculiarities were there about laundering mining clothes, and did he do that or did you do that?
I did the laundry most of the time. Sometimes Lowell would wash his own digging clothes. But because iron ore is hematite and HEMA is red, and the ore was red, you did your hematite clothes in a separate washer, because you could never get your other washer clean enough to do whites and sheets and that kind of thing. So we had two washing machines. Our kids grew up when we had Speed Queens. I remember we had a Speed Queen wringer washer. Oh, that was great. And it was electric, as opposed to my mother ever having to use one, you know, by turning it by hand. And we also had an old Maytag washer that we acquired from a neighbor, and that's what we washed his digging clothes in.
That was also a wringer washer?
That was a wringer washer. And of course, Maytags go on forever and ever. And so he would bring his clothes home every week. When he got to work, that was when he was underground. I washed him every week. And the mine, the water would be so red, you'd have to rinse and rinse two and three times in order to get them clean enough. They'd still be stained red, but at least the dirt was out, because mine ore has kind of an oily consistency too. So it was hard to get them clean. And then we'd hang them out on the line, because we didn't have any dryers. And Lowell used to wear a skull cap under his hard helmet. And a skull cap is, just exactly that. It was a cloth hat that I made. If you look at a man's build baseball cap, take the bill off, and make the crown into cloth, then that was a skull cap. And that kept their hair clean and their scalps clean from the dirt and the redness, because you'd have to scrub too hard to get all that out of your hair and out of your scalp. And so we always had two wash machines, one for the family use and one for just for digging clothes. After he began working in the engine house, which was a spotlessly clean area, you couldn't see any red anywhere. It was so clean and painted gray, and his clothes didn't get dirty, although we washed them separately, because there was always dust enough around sometimes, or if he walked outside. But that was what we had to do with mine clothes.
And then, did most people have a separate washing machine, and was it a new washing machine, or would you get them used somewhere, or how would you be able to afford two washing machines?
Well, we couldn't afford two new ones. No, we did. When someone wanted to upgrade and get classy, they bought a new washing machine. They'd advertise an old one, or say, "I'm getting rid of one," or even some of them threw them in the dump, and men would go there and salvage perfectly good equipment. But we needed two machines to keep up with dealing with jobs working in the mines. What was the other half of that question?
I think you answered it.
Oh.
The other question is, I really need to have you specifically describe what this red is. Is it a cherry red, an apple
No.
red? What color red is
No.
it?
It's a dull red, a brick red. And if you were to take standard brick red and pulverize it, that's what iron ore dust and looks like. It's a deep stain. It covers everything. And when I was a girl growing up, we always knew when the shift was going to change by looking at Carp River, because they discharged the wastewater from their dries and all into the rivers, and when the men were washing up, all of a sudden you'd see all this red come floating down, and that was another thing. Then you didn't want to go swimming. We swam in the Carp River, but then you didn't want to swim in it.
And this would have been when you were a child?
When I was a girl.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a kid.
I'm going to talk about shift work just a little bit, and I imagine some of the idiosyncrasies of shift work are common to anybody who does it, but what impact was there on the home life when there was a shift change from day to afternoon and then to midnight shift. When Daddy was midnight shift, if the kids were home, they had to keep quiet. Daddy needed to sleep. And they knew that, and they were good. You played outdoors. Even if they played outdoors, you didn't play underneath Dad's window or in the yard yelling. That was when they could go over to the schoolyard and play with other kids and that kind of thing. But for years, Lowell did work shift work, but for years he worked midnights because not too many men wanted midnights. And he was willing to work them. It meant extra pay to work that graveyard shift. And so that was another way that Lowell made money. He would work 7 days a week, weeks and weeks and weeks on end, just because we needed the money to get by and build a home and keep up with the needs of the family. And we adapted to the shifts. Ultimately, Lowell had enough time in, and when he finally worked down at the Empire Mine in the open pit area and worked in driving truck or in the garage, he worked day shift. And that was nice, but by that time, kids were gone. And shift work, when the holidays rolled around, if it were Christmas and Lowell had to work Christmas Day, we just got up earlier. Of course, the kids were ready to get up before the crack of dawn to see what Santa Claus brought. But we would get up early. They'd open their things to see what Santa brought. I would give Lowell his breakfast. He would go to work. They would play with their Christmas things all day. And then we had our Christmas dinner when he came home at 4 o'clock. And so it was no inconvenience. It was, you just adapted to the routines of his work schedule and worked around it, because that's what kept us alive and kept us going. We grew up in mining communities, in mining families, and this was so familiar to us that there was nothing unusual.
Can we talk a little bit about, I know we have a couple more things that I want to cover, and then see what other comments you have. If you would comment on the do-it-yourself philosophy, or you know, how common was the do-it-yourself concept and how important was it? And also, does that tie in with any concept that you have of stoicism? Was there a perception, or do you have a perception that there was any stoicism involved in the way that people worked during the time when the underground mines were flourishing?
I don't know about stoicism. I never thought of that. But we grew up with an English grandfather. My mother came home to take care of her stepmother when she was ill, came home for a few days and stayed the rest of her life, which is why my father then left his job in Marquette at the prison and came home to a job closer. And we grew up with Granddad, and he was English, old English. There was a frequent saying, you know, they're not worth their salt, which meant you had to work for what you had. We grew up with a strong work ethic. And we grew up with the philosophy that if you want it, you have to work for it. If you want it, you had to have the money to pay for it. We were working gave you self-esteem. Achieving and being of value, I guess, depended on whether or not you were willing to
roll up your sleeves and pitch in and do. And then, of course, that meant that we had to be do-it-yourselfers because we didn't have the money. Coming back from service in 5220 was certainly not anything surplus. It carried us through while Lowell was trying to find a job and getting settled. But Lowell takes a great sense of pride in building and creating and making for himself. My brother felt the same way, my uncle the same way. If you wanted it, you built it, you made it. For me, sewing and running the house depended on how thrifty I could be. And being thrifty is not being stingy. It's a challenge to be able to create and to acquire with ingenuity and skill and talent. And we're proud of the fact that we live in a house that Lowell built. We live in a camp that Lowell built. And other people seem to admire Dennis. We are do-it-yourselfers with pride.
And just a couple more topics. You and your contemporaries, pretty much the generation of women who were at home when their children were younger, were homemakers, at least until the kids were at some point in their older school years. Do you have any sense or any perception of things that were ingrained in women of that generation, women's traditions or things that the women did consciously as a group to get by or to help each other out or to support each other or to listen to each other or to share responsibilities for children, any of those kinds of things that would fit in any of those ideas that were peculiar to the women that are your contemporaries?
Well, my friends were all women who stayed at home and raised their children. We babysat for each other to give each other the freedom to do some of the extra things where it would take you away from home. Or some of my friends had part-time jobs. But the majority of the women who worked, for instance, at the Gossard garment factory, worked by necessity. Either their husbands were dead or had lost their jobs or the women were single. But most of those women worked at a sewing machine. And some of the women worked as clerks. A few of them did some office work, but none of them ever paid very much money. I went back to school when the girls were both in college. Mellie was at St. Joseph's School of Nursing in Hancock, and Roxy was going to Northern, and then she finished her degree out in the University of San Francisco. But when the girls went to college, then I decided that I wanted to go back to school, and I did. And I had always wanted to be a nurse, and so I ultimately became a nurse. And worked and went to school while I was still in LPN. I worked and finished as an RN. And then it became easy for us because we lived on one income. We lived on my income and put Lowell's income away, and I had monies put away into a sheltered annuity program. And we then could become comfortable. But other women who didn't get into that kind of, go back to school, had to get by on the little pittance that they paid women in those days to supplement whatever their husbands made, or maybe for their own pin money. But my mother said she wished that there had been jobs for women or opportunities for women when she was growing up where she could have supplemented the income, because they were, economics are cyclical. There's ups and downs, and when you're on the downside, and one of the things my mother taught me was, when things are looking really good, be careful because they're going to bust, and put something away. So we learned to put something away and to tide us over on the tough times. Did I answer your question?
Mm-hmm. You touched on another topic that I wanted to talk about a little more too, and that is the education of your children. How that was financed, and what each of them is doing as an adult, and whether any of them has children, and briefly where they live and what they do.
Well, Roxy was always an exceptional student. She was brilliant, and which is not unusual for brilliant people. Sometimes school was hard for her because she and one of her friends were so quick that it was hard to wait for the others to catch up. Ultimately, Roxy became an anthropologist. She laughs and calls herself an osteologist because she's become quite a bone specialist, in that she can read the bones of mummies and determine illnesses and injuries and that kind of thing. And today she's an Egyptologist living in Switzerland and Cairo, involved in digs in Peru, the Southwest, Campsville excavations in Illinois. She's an interesting person. But she went through college on scholarships. Now, Melody is a very bright person and a good student and always had good grades. She always wanted to be a nurse, and so she went to St. Joe's School of Nursing in Hancock, but we paid for that because there was no nursing scholarship that she could dig up. And so,
do you recall what her tuition per semester or per year would have been?
At the end of 3 years, it cost us $4,500 because she gave her dad her cap with the black band and her school pin, and she said, "Well, Daddy, here's what your $4,500 bought." But later on, in a couple of years, she was married, and then while living in Minneapolis, went into a school of anesthesia and put in another 18 months and is now certified nurse anesthetist, and she specialized in pediatric anesthesia, so she's a very highly skilled person and working in St. Louis. She has two boys. One is Miles Michael Anderson, who is 17, will be 17 on June 2nd this year, and the other boy is Jared Reed, and he is 12, going to be 13.
Jared Reed Anderson.
Jared Reed Anderson, yes, I beg. And I don't know what they're doing. Jared says he's going to be an actor, and I think he just might because he has a personality. Miles is undecided. He's finding his way, I think.
And what is Michael doing now?
Michael Keith Smale lives in Temple City, California. He's married to Donna Anderson, Donna Smale, and he's a self-employed carpenter. He's very happy there. He's a fine young man. Well, he's in his 40s now, but that's young to me. and has two stepchildren, is a grandfather, proud grandfather of two little girls. Interestingly, he's about 6'4", 6'5", and 300 pounds, and he does the most beautiful needlework you'd like to see. He can do needlepoint, and he makes things for his grandchildren, and enjoys being creative that way.
What about medical care? We haven't talked about medical care at all. Did your kids require a lot of medical care? Was it readily available? Was it covered by insurance? Was it affordable?
When Lowell first started with the CCI still had Bell Memorial Hospital in Ishpeming. Was just the Ishpeming Hospital. They had, I think, $2 a month taken out of their paychecks. And then that gave you free services at the hospital. You just went to the doctor. It didn't cost you anything. They had a pharmacy there. You were given your prescriptions. When it came to the penicillins and your other antibiotics, then you paid money. And I don't remember offhand what they would have cost, but it was a tremendous benefit that was given to us. Later on, as the unions became more powerful and gained us more benefits, then we had even more benefits, eyeglasses and dental and that kind of thing. Prior to that, we paid for our own eyeglasses at our own doctors. We paid for our own dental bills, which was not terribly expensive then either. But early on, we had when the company owned the hospital and provided and had their own doctors, the men had their annual exams, and so their physical needs were taken care of. And when Roxy was born, I think it cost us $50. I had to stay in the hospital like 10 days, but she was born with anemia and wound up down in the Cousins Clinic in Marquette, which has now been absorbed by Marquette General. But and she was transfused at 11 days, and we used to have to go back and forth to for checkups for her. When Melody was born 2 years later, it cost a whole $150 because we had to pay for her stay in the nursery, and I had a tubal ligation after the second baby, so that because I was having cardiac problems during pregnancy, and so those are the only two children that I was allowed to have, but it was by far cheaper, covered by the hospital, and as I remember, it was we had to pay, the men paid $2 and had this coverage.
And even then, the $150 charge for Melody's birth was the entire hospital bill.
Exactly, that was my stay, nursery stay, surgery, and food for the baby. Well, the babies were breastfed, but it covered all the expenses for mother and infant. Food.
During the time that Lowell worked at the mine, was there ever a strike that affected the family at all?
Yes, there was a strike. And I believe it was in the 60s? But Lowell continued to go to work, and they called him a scab, and they tried stoning his car, but he said, I have to put bread on the table, I have a wife and kids to feed, I can get by on what I make, I don't know what you're striking for, which didn't make him very popular. It got pretty violent, because just over $3 down there was a family where the people would gather out in mobs and shout and carry on. It was kind of frightening. And even across the street from us, right here, they mistook the old couple's house that was there, and someone put burning rags inside the door, between the outside door and the inner door, to start a fire, but they had the wrong house. But they would have been willing to burn that house down to get back at the other family.
And you suspect that they thought this was your house?
No, they weren't looking for our house. They were looking for the family that lived three blocks down from us. And that was a scary time. But Lowell, he's a bit scotch. He's not only thrifty, but he gets pretty firm sometimes when he has an idea, and he was not going to let anybody keep him from going to work. He felt, I had bills to pay. I must go.
Do you remember how long that strike lasted? Approximately?
I think 4, 5, 6 weeks, I'm thinking.
Was Lowell the only one that crossed the picket line that you're aware of?
No. There were others. Lowell was working in the engine house at the time. There were others who felt the same way. There was never any, a lot of hostility turned toward us. It never carried over from just the picket line at the properties. I'd like to finish by saying that Lowell and I had $80 when we were married. And now that we're retired, by being thrifty and making do and being careful with our money and investing it in a sheltered annuity and in bonds and CDs and all, that we are at a point in our life where we are in our golden years. Taxes come around. We don't worry about paying them. We can buy anything we wish. But our wants are few, our needs are nothing. We have need for nothing, I should say. And our wants are few. We're blessed. Thrift is what I have to underline. Save and prepare for your golden years, because Social Security is not the answer by far. Thank you for listening.